Hello and welcome to Junk Dilemmas, an Urban Welsh podcast. My name is Damien Kiley. I am your host. And this is episode 2. It is part 2 of Trainspotting, the book. So if you haven't listened to episode 1, probably best to go back and listen to that. Not to sound too much like Blind Boy there. But just a couple of things again to clarify. I'm not in any way affiliated with Irvin Welsh. I'm just a fan of his. So any views or opinions expressed in this podcast are purely mine. And just to point out the social media accounts that Junk Dilemmas now has. So on Facebook, you can look for us on Junk Dilemmas and Irvin Welsh Podcast. On Instagram, it's junk_dilemmas. Or on Twitter, it's junk_dilemmas. So check them out for exciting content. And also, obviously, to tell you when the next episodes are out. But we're going to get back into it. We're about halfway through the book. We're breaking down by chapter by chapter. So let's get back into it. So we're into the next section then, which is Blowing It. And the first chapter is entitled Courting Disaster. And it does start with Renton and Spud up in court after being caught stealing books. And they're up in front of the judge. So just some funny bits here. There's one, you know, one of the books that that Renton stole anyway was a book by Kierkegaard. And the magistrate remarks, "Oh, you're a fan of his. Can you tell me about him, Mr. Renton?" You know, being patronizing. But Renton is actually able to surprise him when he retorts that, you know, "I'm interested in his concepts of subjectivity and truth, particularly his ideas concerning choice." So you can only imagine the look on the judge's face at this. And I think apart from kind of being smug about it in that sense, Renton plays a better game and is able to convince the judge that, you know, it was almost a once-off for him and that he's seeking help and wants to get off heroin, where Spud, you know, just doesn't have the backstory prepared to get himself a lighter sentence. And it basically results in Spud getting 10 months in prison and Renton is fined £100, but is, you know, set free. And, you know, the judge remarks that about Renton, you know, "You claim that your behaviour is related to depression experienced due to withdrawal from the drug. I'm prepared to accept this." You know, so Renton's pulled the wool over his eyes with that one. I love the line that he says back to the judge, and it is in the film as well. You know, "Thank you, Your Honour. With God's help, I'll beat this disease." I think it's worded slightly differently in the movie, but I love the reaction from the judge where he's looking closely at Renton to check if he is taking the piss out of him. But as it's written in the book, "No chance that it'll show. I'm used to keeping deadpan when I'm winding up Begbie." And then the next scene in the same chapter is, you know, they're kind of celebrating with drinks back in their local. So even Renton's brother Billy is there with his parents, and Begbie is there as well. And there's some funny moments. There's one bit where Renton's mother tells him to watch his language. You know, she turns to Billy and says, "You as well. I don't know where the Perry has heard that. You never heard it growing up in my house." And Billy even raises eyebrows, dubiously looking at Renton. And they, you know, Renton does the gesture back. So it's kind of a rare display of sibling unity between the two. And then poor Spud's mother comes in. Now, it's interesting. She's a bit more aggressive than she was when she appeared in the movie. In the movie, she doesn't say anything. She just comes in and sees them celebrating Renton's freedom and looks really sorry for herself and gets verbally attacked by Begbie. But in the book, she does provoke him a bit more. She's coming in and saying, "It's not bloody fair. I know it was you." You know, she's accusing Renton of almost being the ringleader. She's accusing Sick Boy. She's even accusing Begbie as well. And I love the reaction to Sick Boy, where he says nothing but just raises his hand slowly from the chair, as if to say, "I've never been so insulted in my life," followed by a sad, patronising shake of his head. And of course, Begbie reacts angrily and is telling her that's fucking out of order. And I love that Irvin Welsh writes, "There's no sacred cows for that cunt, not even Elwyn's from Leet, whose laddies have just been sent to jail." And you see the kind of dynamic in the Renton family, where Billy's mother is looking at him with awe and pride. You know, he's done the family proud serving in the army, and he's just about to become a father himself. And he's very much the golden boy in the house. And as Renton says, "Forgotten is the fact that the cunt has brought the lab dicks round to the house more times than I've ever done, discussing, you know, what the sex will be of Billy's baby. And Begbie says, if it's a lassie, take it back. A sick boy starts slapping him on the back and patronising, encouraging him, you know, saying that's the spirit, Franco, trying to encourage the Raj to give him even more rope so that he'll come up with another classic Begbie crass comment or two. And Renton remarks that we collect all of his stupid, most sexist and violent quotes so we can use them when we're impersonating him when he's not around. You know, the game was to have an edge, thinking about how he'd respond if he ever found out. Sick boy had even started making faces behind his back. But he does remark that, you know, one day either one of us or both of us will go too far and get caught, which I think eventually does happen. And there's another funny bit where sick boy, Renton spots sick boy buying around the drinks and making a total meal of it, you know, waving his money about, being the big generous man. But then Renton realises that Begbie had actually given sick boy the money to get the round in. It is at this point that it apparently becomes news that sick boy is becoming a pimp. You know, he's talking about his plans for the future, and Renton does scorn him for this, but sick boy retaliates by scorning him for basically getting Tommy onto heroin. And Tommy does come into the pub at some point, and again, his only aim at this point in life is to get a score. So, you know, even the other guys are looking down on him and shaking their heads. But everyone that's involved in the book, you know, in terms of Renton's immediate friends and family, are all present in the pub. But it's at this point where he possibly says my favourite line in the book. He says, I'm surrounded by all the cunts that are closest to us, but I've never felt so alone, never in my puff. It's actually at this point that he decides that he, you know, needs a fix and sneaks out to go to Swanee's again. And the next chapter is another Junk Dilemmas, number 66. It's a very short passage, and it's really just Renton remarking on how the heroin that he's taken has removed his ability to move. It's quite a subtle last score in terms of him, you know, he gets off heroin for a good while after this. It's obviously a lot more hard-hitting in the novel or in the book, where he actually overdoses and leads him to then go into rehab and get off heroin for a while. You know, it's the famous scene where he overdoses and is taken to hospital with Lou Reed's Perfect Day playing in the background, but that, you know, that section is not in the book. And it's followed by a chapter which, you know, I think is best described as black humor. You know, it's funny, it's certainly played out funny in the movie, but in the book it's a bit more sinister. So in the movie it's Renton and sick boy with an air rifle and a pair of binoculars looking for basically victims to shoot this air rifle at and cause mayhem. But in the book, it's just sick boy. So he has this air rifle and he's looking for people to shoot. And he does shoot a dog who then attacks its skinhead owner. And that gives sick boy the opportunity to run in and basically act like the hero and rescue this man. But he actually does it by grabbing hold of the dog and strangling it with its own collar, which, you know, is horrific. As I say, it plays out with much more comic relief in the movie. But, you know, he takes delight when the police officer arrives and informs sick boy that he'll be recommended for accommodation. And that leads us into the next chapter, which I think is a very important one. It's entitled Searching for the Inner Man. It's narrated by Renton, and it's him in rehab, and he's obviously been assigned to various psychiatrists and, you know, counsellors to try and help him with his addiction and get to the bottom of why he takes heroin. And sort out his life for him, essentially. So, he's visiting various different psychiatrists who are using different techniques based on kind of famous 20th century psychologists' theories. And I think it comes across, you know, ambiguous, at least to me, as to whether Renton is taking their advice on board or whether he really does think that they're all just talking shite. But there's kind of different views here. There's a Dr. Forbes, who's a psychiatrist, and, you know, he uses non-directive counselling techniques. And there's a funny line here where he says, apparently I have Oedipal feelings towards my mother and an attendant unresolved jealousy towards my father. My junk behaviour is anal in concept, attention-seeking, yes, but instead of withholding the feces to rebel against parental authority, I'm putting smack into my body to claim power over its vis-a-vis society in general. Raj. And it, you know, there's mention here that psychiatrist is talking to him about his time in Edinburgh in college, and you know that he didn't really take to college at all. He didn't make friends there. That he spent his grant money on prostitutes. But he does kind of get out of him that he feels guilty about not making more of an effort with his disabled brother, who had severe mental and physical disabilities and died a couple of years beforehand. And you can only imagine that, you know, how hard that was on Renton's parents and the family in general to deal with, both with the child, with his brother Davy growing up, and with his death. There's also a counsellor's opinions recorded here, Tom Kurtzen. It tells Renton that I despise myself and the world because I've failed to face up to my own and life's limitations. He believes that I'm suffering from low self-esteem and that I'm refusing to acknowledge that by projecting the blame onto society. And Renton does say that this is fairly common and sounds familiar to me anyway. And Renton also, you know, remembers his ex Hazel, just before she told him that she didn't want to see him anymore, that she remarked that you just want to fuck up on drugs so that everyone will think how deep and fucking complex you are. It's pathetic and fucking boring. And I really get this, you know, taking drugs, you think that it makes you interesting and it really doesn't. But there's a great line in here as well, you know, which makes me think that he's really just going through the motions with these psychiatrists and doesn't really take anything they say on board. But there's a good line where he says, it was either this or jail, and I'm now starting to think that Spud got the soft option. But the chapter then ends out of nowhere with possibly the most marketable and recognisable monologues of the book, and obviously the movie as well. So I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but basically it's a society invents a spurious, convoluted logic to absorb and change people whose behaviour is outside its mainstream. In inverted commas, choose life, choose us, choose mortgage payments, etc. Well, I choose not to choose life. If the cunts can't handle that, it's their fucking problem. So I just think it's mad that this super famous slogan, you know, from the book and the movie just appears out of nowhere. It's definitely the most famous thing most people will say if you say to quote a line from Trainspotting, and it's just plopped in here in the middle of what really is, you know, an important chapter in kind of shaping Mark Renton, whether you believe what these psychiatrists and counsellors have said about him or not. But there's a lot to look into and think about there. And the next chapter is entitled House Arrest, and it is Renton, you know, locked in his room, suffering from severe withdrawal, where it's his parents' attempt to really get him off heroin once and for all. So it's interesting, he's in his room and he's describing it. There's obviously a lot of Hibs FC paraphernalia, but there's no mention of any Trains wallpaper, which, you know, is famously included in the film. But he does remark that there's a poster of Iggy Pop on his wall, and it's one of Iggy Pop smashing a pile of records with a claw hammer. I have looked up that picture, and it's quite a striking image of Iggy Pop. But there's some funny, interesting lines in here. There's a section where he's thinking to himself, and he does actually remark that some people say that the Irish are the trash of Europe. That's shite. It's the Scots. The Irish had the bottle to win their country back, or at least most of it. And I suppose that's a slight play on the famous speech from the movie where he's talking about it shite being Scottish. That does come up again in the novel itself. We also see an early example here of Welch kind of distorting the layout of text, you know, for effect on the page. He's using a lot of full caps here when he's describing the thoughts that are running through Renton's head when he's, you know, lying tortured in his bed. And it's used to great effect when he starts, you know, almost hallucinating that he's being attacked by almost a vampire version of poor baby Don, who, you know, obviously there's a famous scene in the film to go along with this, but it sounds much more horrific in the book. He also gets a visit from, as he describes, Don's dad, Sick Boy. And, you know, so Sick Boy is playing up to his parents. You know, he's having jocular and matey banter about football with Renton's old man, and he's coming across like a concerned GP or family friend to Renton's mother. And it's gassed that Renton's parents, they love young Simon, but they kind of blame scruffy, lazy Spud for being the bad influence on Renton. And Sick Boy remarks that, you know, he's going to be out of town. He's going to be in France on one of his escapades. And it's kind of the first time that Renton starts thinking about getting out of Leet himself. And there's a good passage here where Welsh writes that Renton is saying, the limitations and ugliness of this place have been exposed to us, and I could never see it in the same light again. The pain is being replaced by an ugly, stark, black depression, and I've never known such a sense of complex, complete and utter hopelessness, punctuated only by bouts of raw anxiety. So you can really see the examples of mental illness coming into effect here with Renton when he's, you know, trying to get off the heroin. There's some funny lines in here as well, though. He remarks that his father is trying to grow a moustache and looks like a liberated Freddie Mercury clone. And interestingly, he's also going around at one point, Renton is singing She's Lost Control by Joy Division. And he actually strangely compares Matty, his friend, to Ian Curtis, which is an interesting comment. Also another mention of Swanee here. And again, he's not shown in a very nice light. He's being less than sympathetic to Leslie, Don's mother, who has obviously gone on a downward spiral after her baby's death. But Swanee is actually jealous that she's getting decent heroin while she's in hospital. The chapter ends then with a funny segment where funny for us, probably torturous for Renton himself, where he's allowed on a night out, but accompanied by the close eye of his parents. So they go to the local Dockers Club. And I suppose it would probably remind everyone who, as a teenager, was subjected to kind of evenings out or Sunday drives out with their parents and were either embarrassed to be with them or put into the company of, you know, torturous people, older people. And it's just interesting that, you know, he's forced to watch his parents dancing to Neil Diamond, and he's introduced, or at least in the company of these other characters that he wouldn't normally be. There's a mention of a guy called Jockey who sits there to socialize with his parents like a Leith version of Al Jolson in his element in this Dockers Club. And it's just a funny couple of passages. It's played out a little bit more than it was in the movie, where you see Renton accompanied by his parents at a bingo game, and there's just this great shot in Trainspotting the film where the camera pans out and everyone around him is speeding up, but he's just there almost in slow motion with this lost look on his face. And I love that image. And the next chapter is called Bang to Rights. And again, it's narrated by Renton, and it's kind of a continuation of his road to recovery from heroin. But at this point in the novel, his brother Billy has been killed while serving for the British Army in Northern Ireland. And it's interesting that at the funeral, you get a mixture of, you know, Protestants from Renton's father's side and Catholics. Billy's coffin is actually draped in a Union Jack. So it's probably a weird situation, but I imagine it's not uncommon in certain parts of Scotland. It's a more severe version of when brothers end up supporting different football teams. You know, and Renton does actually remember that Billy nearly choked him a couple of times, you know, when they were fighting over supporting Hearts and Hibs while growing up. So you see, you know, a nasty side to Billy. He doesn't come across as a terribly nice character, it has to be said. But actually at the funeral, Renton gets a case of the giggles that, you know, he just can't help. It's like he's in school and just can't stop laughing. And he has a bit of a run in with one of his uncles on his father's side, who is a Protestant. And at this point, Renton does wish that Begbie was actually at the funeral to kind of give him some backup. But he's actually away in Benidorm, and he's, you know, Sick Boy is away at this point as well. He's more or less on his own at this funeral, even though he's surrounded by family. But he's, you know, as we said before, he's very much the black sheep of his family, or at least when he's surrounded by a large contingent of Protestants. Nina, who had been mentioned in a previous chapter, is there again. And Renton, you know, finds her attractive and makes a pass at her when he's drunk. So it's another questionable character trait for him. And it actually leads to him following his brother Billy's girlfriend Sharon, who's heavily pregnant, into the toilets and ends up having sex with her in there. And it's one of the more eyebrow raising sections of the book, you know, where he's kind of suffering from almost intrusive thoughts while he's having sex with her. You know, he wonders if Billy can see them, and he actually hopes so. So he's, you know, showing that kind of malicious side again. And he's thinking about how she's pregnant, and he starts thinking that, you know, perhaps he's getting a ride and a blowjob at the same time, which, you know, it's a very questionable image. And it's just, I remember the first time reading that, and it's really eyebrow raising. There is also at this point a mention to his poor genital hygiene. Again, I can't imagine Ewan McGregor suffering from this in the film. It's not something that was brought up too much. It's not really a marketable character trait for a movie character, certainly not in Trainspotting anyway. There's a kind of funny line in here where Renton thinks to himself that Sharon was certainly far too good for Billy, but then again, Moira Hindley or Margaret Thatcher would have been too good for Billy. And Sharon herself actually mentions that Billy used to hit her. So again, we see a bad side to Renton's brother here as well, which, you know, it's not really justification for the fact that, you know, Renton is having sex with his girlfriend at his brother's funeral. But, you know, it's strange. The chapter does end with Renton kind of remembering that Billy used to protect him from certain local heavies at certain points growing up. So there's a mixture here of, you know, there's mixed feelings towards the recently departed Billy. But it's really one of those chapters that's kind of warts and all, and just shows, you know, this all sides of Renton, not just the kind of cool or good-natured sides to his character. And the next chapter is another Junk Dilemmas. It's actually the last of the actual Junk Dilemmas. It's number 67, and it involves Renton remarking and that the dilemmas only actually materialize after the junk runs out. So even now, he's seeing the pros of using heroin, even after he's managed to get off it. So we're into the next section now. It's section 5, entitled Exile. And the first chapter is London Crawling. So again, it's narrated by Renton. So he's made his way down to London once again. I suppose it's interesting that you see all these trips back up and down to London, which is reminiscent of the man himself, Irvine Welsh. He used to do this a lot in his teenage or younger years. It's quite an eyebrow-raising chapter once again for certain parts in it. But essentially, Renton has come down and can't find anyone else that he's, you know, friendly with down in London. He's checked in all the different addresses, the squats, and nobody's about whatsoever. So he's kind of left wandering around himself and trying to find stuff to do. It is at this point that, you know, when he's down in London, he does remark about the kind of British Empire. And there's a funny little passage here where he says, "I've never felt British because I'm not. It's ugly and artificial. I've never really felt Scottish either, though. Scotland the brave, my arse. Scotland the shiting cunt. We'd throttle the life out of each other for the privilege of rimming some English aristocrats' piles." And it's at this point that he wanders into a very seedy all-night porno theatre, which, you know, is obviously frequented by some very questionable characters. They're showing porn films, but as well as that, they're showing at one point a violent documentary which shows animals tearing each other apart in exotic locations. And they also start showing a film called The Office Party, which is like a kind of soft porn, almost carry-on type film. As Renton says, it's like a carry-on film with less humour and more sex. And it's actually starring the actor Johnny Briggs, who would famously play Mike Baldwin in Coronation Street. And it's actually the first of two times that Mike Baldwin is mentioned in Trainspotting. I think he's mentioned in the very next chapter as well. I do actually wish that Danny Boyle had somehow cast him in Trainspotting. That would have been interesting. But at one point in this cinema, Renton is propositioned by a man, and he scorns his advances, but he does think to himself that he remembers one time he'd picked up a gorgeous young queen in the London Apprentice, and there was an exchange of fellatio. So there's an example there of a bisexual side to Renton, which, you know, isn't addressed anywhere else in the book, and it's certainly not addressed in the movie either. But Renton, he does eventually agree to go back to this man's house, possibly more so for having nowhere else to go. And it's interesting, he does remark at one point that there's a flicker of doubt in his head when he remembers Dennis Nielsen. And I just wonder, was Irvine Welsh actually living down in London when Dennis Nielsen's infamous reign of terror came to light in the early 80s. But Renton does go back to this man's flat and at some point falls asleep, and then wakes up at some point afterwards to find this man basically masturbating on top of him. And obviously he gets quite angry at first, But he seems to then feel sorry for this man and, you know, surprisingly agrees to still stay in his company. You know, he takes him for breakfast and then he actually takes him to a party that he's heard about somewhere else in London. And I think this party kind of reminded me of one or two I might have gone to myself in earlier life, where you're essentially gay crashing it and going from room to room, you know, looking for a familiar face or at least some sort of meaningful social interaction, and oftentimes not succeeding, so just getting wasted. The chapter ends then with him again finding this older Italian man at the party, and it's just a small passage here where he says, Ouija is standing by the fireplace sipping a can of lager. He looks frightened and bemused. I think to myself, I might just end up whapping it up the wee cunt's chalk box yet. The thought depresses the fuck out of me. Still, we're all slags on holiday. And I suppose it's a mixture of predatory and pathetic. You know, he's contemplating a gay encounter out of what just seems to be desperation or boredom. And I suppose it's interesting that Welch himself has talked about going down to London and just doing stuff that you wouldn't normally do in Edinburgh. And I'm not implying anything there at all, but, you know, it's probably true to say that your inhibitions go out the door when you're away from home, where there's less people around who know you. And the next chapter is entitled Bad Blood, and it's narrated by Davy Mitchell. It's really an unforgettable chapter. It's possibly the darkest in the book. It's pretty much a separate story in itself. And it was actually made into a short film starring Alan Cumming's. I've seen it. It's quite good. Although, of course, if they'd gotten a certain David Mitchell from Peep Show, all joking aside, I think he could have actually pulled it off, playing this character in a sinister kind of ironic way. But it is amazing to think that this is the same character who was involved in such a comedic chapter earlier on in the book, the traditional Sunday breakfast, where he shat the bed. But it's a revenge tale. It's a particularly nasty revenge tale. Essentially, he's taking revenge on a man who he suspects or knows raped his ex-girlfriend and gave her HIV and in turn gave him HIV. So he starts attending a health group for HIV victims called HIV and Positive. And there is a funny line earlier on where he's speaking to the counselor who runs the group, who's the counselor says, I'm just concerned that you're spending a lot of time with Alan. Watching him wasting away won't be good for you. And besides, Alan was hardly the most positive member of the group. To which Davy Mitchell remarks, well, he was certainly the most HIV positive member. So this is Alan Venters, who was mentioned in one of the earlier chapters. He's the guy who was assaulting his girlfriend in full view of everyone in a pub, and to which Tommy took exception. So this man has obviously gone on to worse things than assaulting a woman in a public bar. So Davy Mitchell, in order to kind of get in with Alan Venters and earn his trust, actually tells a lie at the group. There's a section here where it says, At a group session, I told the first of several lies, the trail of which would lead to my grip on the soul of Alan Venters. I told the group that I had had unprotected penetrative sex with people, knowing full well that I was HIV positive and that I now regretted it. And the room went deadly silent. So he basically seduces Alan Venters into thinking that he's as much a piece of shit as he is. I do like the passage where he remarks that he'd done a degree in chemistry at university, but he had never approached the studies of any subject with the rigor or enthusiasm with which he was approaching the study of Venters. So he realizes that, you know, Alan Venters is dying, and, you know, in which case, how do you hurt a man who doesn't give a toss anymore? So he discovered that there was only one way he could hurt him. And that turns out to be true, as Alan Venters says, his wee felly. So Alan Venters has a son with a woman called Frances. And Davy Mitchell actually starts courting Frances himself, which coincides with Venters' decline into serious illness. And, you know, he's incapacitated at a hospice. So Davy Mitchell has to kind of hatch his plan and time it to coincide with just the right moment to execute this revenge plan for when Alan Venters is literally on death's door. As he says himself, the disease could have Alan Venters' body, but it could also take his mind, in which case it would be depriving him of his revenge. And it's gas in the middle of this dark, dark chapter. Mr. Mike Baldwin of Coronation Street fame appears yet again. It's when Davy Mitchell is visiting his parents, and Mike Baldwin has mentioned this wheeler-dealer, ladies' man, as he was. But Davy Mitchell does make an interesting comparison between himself and Mike Baldwin. He says, Mike had apparently reached a point where he had to confront live-in lover Alma Sedgwick and tell her that he was really into rich widow Jackie Ingram. Mike couldn't help it. He was a prisoner of love, a force external to himself, which compelled him to behave the way he did. I could, as Tom would have put it, emphasize, I was a prisoner of hate, a force which was an equally demanding taskmaster. You can kind of see where this need for revenge has totally gripped Davy Mitchell at this point. So this horrible act that Davy Mitchell does kind of plays off the pages, as it were, but it comes to light later in the novel when he goes to visit Alan Venters for the last time. So he does remark, though, that afterwards I felt terrible. Was he any better than Alan Venters himself? But as he says, bad as I felt then, it was only a foretaste of the horror that hit me when I developed the photographs. So we're slowly seeing, just how dark this chapter is. When he goes to visit Alan Venters, he reveals himself to him, who he actually was, and he retells the story of his ex-girlfriend Donna being horribly raped at knife point by a man who, of course, is Alan Venters. But at this point, obviously, Venters doesn't care. He's on death's door, and he says to Davy Mitchell, what can you do to me? I'm already dead, essentially. And it's at this point that Davy Mitchell explains his mode of revenge to Venters, which actually mirrors a classic line by Renton talking about the effects of heroin. But in this case, Davy Mitchell says, think about the worst possible thing I could do to make you pissed off, Al, and then multiply it by 1,000 and you're still not even fucking close. So it transpires that Davy Mitchell had actually offered to babysit Alan Venters' son while his ex went out for a night. And he proceeded to drug this child with chloroform and then kind of staged a torture using, fake blood and power tools and just horrific stuff. And he tells Alan Venters that it took, roughly 20 minutes for the child to die. So this is obviously what he wants going through Alan Venters' head, the last thing that he thinks about before he dies. And that's what he wants as revenge. So it's really very hard reading. I remember being disturbed by it the first time I read it. And it's, 100 times worse now when I've read it again as a father. I had a similar reaction when I read Pet Sematary. I read Pet Sematary by Stephen King in, probably the early 90s. And that obviously had an effect on me as well. There's a dead child storyline involved there. But it's just so much worse when you've become a father yourself or a parent for obvious reasons. But he eventually does smother Alan Venters with a pillow. And there's some black humor in here. He's doing it while singing Daddy Cool by Boney M. So it's really fucked up shit. But, obviously, from the point of view, he took a huge risk in chloroforming a child or chloroforming anyone. It's just unforgettable. It's unforgivable behavior for any reason. And it's just a scary aspect to the human mind that he could be so driven by revenge to do this, even in the circumstances that he'd found himself in by contracting HIV, essentially through the actions of Alan Venters. But then amazingly, he kind of goes back to being a good person, or at least a person with good intentions, and has optimism about his, future, or his uncertain future. And there's even a little heartwarming story in here where he had initially told his parents that he was HIV positive and his father had been silent about it, but then turned up on his doorstep afterwards and, they just had a big hug. And it just shows how fucked up this chapter is, and it actually leads to possibly one of the most uplifting, lines in the book, where he says, I wish I hadn't waited so long to become a human being, but better late than never, believe you me. And we never hear from Davy Mitchell again, either in this book or in any other, to my knowledge. But as I say, Bad Blood was made into a short film, starring Alan Cumming, and I think it was directed by a guy called Kyle Lader, who had actually worked with Alan Cumming on X-Men 2. So we're into our next chapter here, which is entitled There Is a Light That Never Goes Out, which of course is a famous song title by the Smiths. This is a third person narration. It's basically centered around the morning after the night before, kind of all night or a couple of days, possibly drinking and partying session by the main gang. And there's a couple of pages of this chapter that are just brilliantly descriptive. And I will read out some of them in the next section of the book, but they really struck me. They're one of my favourite parts of the writing in the book. But there's mention of an old man in the bar that they enter, and he actually recognises one of the group as being his son. And he does consider going over and saying something to him before deciding that he actually has nothing to say. And I like the part as well where he remarks that, you know, he himself had once been young and in the position that this group was in, but the enjoyment and the company faded away, but the drink didn't, and that just ended up expanding and filling the gap left by the enjoyment and company's departure. And you do actually think that the way they're describing it in the book, the way Welch is describing it in the book, that it's Spud he's talking about, but it actually turns out to be Begbie. And the two meet again, and it's mentioned in one of the later chapters, quite an important little chapter actually. But Begbie does spot this old man, and eventually this leads to him getting the group out of this pub into another establishment. But the chapter does focus then on Spud, and he's thinking about a girl that he fancied, who's a Kylie Minogue lookalike, apparently called Nicola. And he's remembering that he had great conversations with this girl, but he just didn't make a move. I think a lot of people can relate to this situation themselves. I know I can. But he compares his own predicament to the Smith song, which is the title of the chapter. And in particular, he remarks on the lines, "And in the darkened underpass, I thought, oh God, my chance had come at last. But then a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask." So you really see the sensitive side of Spud coming out here. But he does then tell a hilarious story about a certain girl called Laura McKeown, a girl with an awesome sexual reputation, apparently. And she had actually asked Spud if he wanted to take her arse virginity, which he, jumped at the chance. So after going back to her place, she tied him to the bed, which he went along with. But then instead of smearing lube on his penis, she actually used Vicks, which, obviously caused excruciating pain to Spud. She did untie him, and he raced to the bathroom and submerged his penis in cold water in the sink. But because of the shock of this, he passed out and actually fell over and walloped his head. And had to be rushed out of there. So apparently he was even more distraught when he found out that a sick boy had been drafted in as his replacement for the frustrated Laura. And obviously sick boy was only too happy to step in there. There's also mentioned that this girl Laura had the reputation of having caused one of her exes to be committed through her promiscuous behaviour. But there's also a little section where they go to a cafe for some breakfast, and Begbie takes exception to the fact that Renton is a vegetarian and won't have a traditional fry up. He remarks that a fucking junkie worried about what he puts in his body. And there's more stories of Renton actually hurting animals here. There's stories of him shooting cats and dogs with air rifles and setting pigeons on fire. Again, questionable behaviour by Renton when it comes to his treatment of animals. I do find it funny that Begbie gets to the jukebox at some point and puts on Berlin and Human League. And it would appear that Edinburgh hard cunts definitely love their middle-of-the-road 80s pop tunes. There's definitely more of that in later episodes, such as Ecstasy. And the chapter kind of ends with Spud and Alison going home together, really through mutual loneliness more than anything. But I think it's a good chapter for character building, and it gives you a more idea of the group dynamic. And it's kind of typical stuff that would remind anyone of nights out with friends. So the next chapter is Feeling Free, and it's the first of two chapters narrated by Kelly. Herself and Alison are subjected to, misogynistic comments by some construction workers, and they kind of fight back. They get into an argument with these guys and basically win the argument, also with the help of some passers-by, including some Australian backpackers. And they actually invite these girls back to their flat, and they're having a laugh with them. And Renton does actually make an appearance, but he's made fun of. You know, they make fun of his masculinity, but I think he takes in good humor, but he then leaves and it kind of makes the women feel guilty for ganging up on him. Kelly remarks that, you know, she feels that men are only all right when they're in the minority. But I think it's interesting in this chapter, Alison is bad mouthing Renton early on, who she thinks is bad for Kelly, but yet she herself lets Sick Boy treat her like shite. But it's interesting as well, Alison is herself off the gear and is making a go of things with life. She's going for job interviews. There is no evidence that she's using speed in these job interviews either, like the Renton and Spud were in an earlier chapter. I think Irvin Welsh was trying to inject some female perspective, you know, into the book or into the group. He'd only slightly done that with Nina in an earlier chapter. And, you know, I think he has some very decent feminist views, you know, and I think he's trying to write with consideration towards women. You know, I don't want to sound patronizing myself there, but this is his first book, but he does eventually write, you know, an entire novel from the point of view of two women. That's the sex lives of Siamese twins, but that would be 21 years after Trainspotting. And the next chapter then is The Elusive Mr. Hunt, which again, it's a third person narration, but it is centered around Kelly. So it's a prank by Sick Boy. He's kind of pulling a Bart Simpson ringing Moe's Tavern style prank here, where he's ringing from a pub across the way looking for someone called Mark Hunt, which leads to Kelly shouting out now to the whole pub that this boy is wanting Mark Hunt. So obviously that gets laughter in the pub, but Renton actually recognizes that the laughter, you know, isn't friendly. They're laughing at her. And she's obviously quite hurt by this. It's kind of recognized by Renton as being lynch mob laughter. But he himself had taken part in it. But then he realizes, you know, but he thinks to himself, how the fuck was I to know? But it's, you know, it's a small chapter, but it does expand on Kelly's frustrations with, I suppose, the often primitive male attitude. And it's building up to her famous chapter in the book, The Disgusting Eating Out, which is coming up. Before I get into the breakdown of Trainspotting, I just want to mention another podcast that I'm involved with at times. If you're a fan of Trainspotting and other classic movies, then you might be a fan of classic UK TV as well, in which case you might love the Tales of the Unexpected podcast. If you remember the show, hosts Chris and Rob are working their way through every episode, talking about the good, the bad, and the weird of Tales of the Unexpected, often veering off course to talk about many other subjects as well. And as I say, from time to time, I am also a guest on the show. So check that out. Search for the Tales of the Unexpected podcast on all good podcast platforms. Okay, so we're into section 6, which is home. And the first chapter in that section is Easy Money for the Professionals. This is a short enough chapter. It's narrated by Spud. And it's kind of a fun little side crime caper story, which kind of really enhances just the qualities of both Spud and Begbie, or lack of qualities in Begbie's case. So they have assigned the talents of a young boy who's managed to get the keys to a shop temporarily out of the shop so that they can copy the key. And then they just walk in and they rob a bag, which they know is in there. And it actually turns out to be containing $2,000. So they're back in Begbie's house. Begbie is paranoid at this point that, you know, he wants to make sure that nobody's going to grass him up. And that is especially aimed at the young boy. So he's particularly vicious to this young lad. He scares him to death. You know, he's thrown darts at his head, but, you know, it's just the flight part, the plastic part. It's not the actual dart. So, you know, he's just scaring this young boy, and Spud is trying to talk him down. But in Begbie's words, there's one thing fucking worse than a grassing cunt, and that's a fucking lippy cunt. So he's worried that this young lad is going to tell somebody what they did and it'll come back on Begbie. But, you know, it's interesting. You see another nod to him being horrible to June, you know, in the house where he's shouting at her. But strangely enough, he's shown affection to Spud almost in a way where, you know, he makes the comment, "That's how I like to go screwing fucking shops," and houses with you, Spud. You're a true fucking professional like myself, and you never say nowt to no cunt, and I respect that fucking professionalism. When you get true professionals on a job, it's nae fucking problem, you cunt. So, as I say, it's just a fun little chapter. And it's followed by a chapter called A Present. So this is narrated by Renton. And it's basically Renton once again coming back from a trip to London. He's on the train at the start, and it's interesting. He's coming back from Matty's funeral. You know, I liked a bit at the start. He's on the train. He's listening to tapes on his Walkman. He's listening to The Fall. He's got some cans of lager, and he's reading a H.P. Lovecraft book. And he remarks that Lovecraft, a Nazi cunt, but he could spin a good yarn. Then he meets up with Gav Temperley again, and Gav describes how Matty has come to his end. So Matty had tried to win his girlfriend back by buying her a kitten, which she wanted none of. So he was back in his living in squalor in his flat with this kitten, and ended up getting what's known as toxoplasmosis, you know, getting an abscess on his brain, and taking more heroin to stop the headaches, and eventually having a stroke and dying. And it's interesting, you know, Renton remarks that Matty had been quite popular when they'd first gone down to London, and happiest down there. And things just started to go really bad for him when he returned to Edinburgh. But the chapter does end with a funny story. Gav has remarked that he'd given Second Prize some money to paint his flat, but hadn't seen him since. So Second Prize had obviously gone off to piss the money up against the wall. But they meet another funny named character known as Perfume James. So-called, not for his demeanour, but because he sells off knocked-off bottles of perfume. So, they know straight away when they meet him that he's going to try and sell them some of this stolen perfume, but they're having none of it. But he does remark that he's already met Second Prize, who bought a big bottle for his girlfriend. So Gav knows that that's after coming out of his money as well. And the next chapter is at Matty's funeral, or after Matty's funeral. It's called Memories of Matty. It's a third person narration, but it kind of covers most of the main characters in the book, kind of reflecting on their thoughts of Matty. So it does start off with a bit where Renton is laughing along with Spud at the priest when the priest remarks that Matty used to like to entertain his friends with his guitar playing, when they both know that he was absolutely shite. And I wonder, is this kind of a reflection on Irvine Welsh himself, who has admitted that he tried to take up music and singing and playing guitar and just wasn't very good at it. Spud himself somehow associates Matty with Australia, because every time he called around to his flat, he was laid over watching Australian soaps in the middle of the day. Alison remembers an embarrassing occasion when herself and Matty had sex. He apparently told her that he was going to fuck her like she'd never been fucked in her life. And he was right. She'd never been fucked so badly, either before or since. She apparently did tell him that it was rubbish to his face. And she did actually notice that there was tears in his eyes as she left. And this image had stuck with her as she was looking at him in the coffin. And she'd wished that she'd been a bit kinder to him. Begbie is, of course, angry at the situation. He kind of sees it as a personal insult that one of his friends has died, that, you know, he somehow could have glassed the stroke and protected Matty from it. He kind of quickly deals with the confused feelings of hurt by remembering a time when Matty ran away from a fight and didn't back him up, which apparently involved none other than Mikey Forrester on the opposing team. So apparently Begbie had paid Matty back physically and mentally afterwards for this betrayal. Matty's brother Anthony is also mentioned, and he has resentment against the other Skag boys for, you know, he obviously blames them for Matty's demise. But again, he himself remembers an embarrassing occasion where he'd been beaten up as a boy by a younger guy and had gotten his older brother Matty to back him up on this. But when Matty tried to get revenge for him, he also got a hiding. So this was obviously a great embarrassment to his brother Anthony, as well as Matty himself. His ex, Shirley, the mother of his child, she resents the priest calling Matty a good father, as he was far from it. And she also remembers that he was somewhat of a closet romantic and actually used to write her love poems. But then, in a kind of a sinister twist to this memory, she remembers that he once set fire to one and telling her that she shouldn't have unrealistic dreams. So, you know, it really comes across that Matty was this disturbed, unnerving individual with a lot of bad qualities. you know, almost destined to have bad luck in life and be depressed. And, you know, you come across characters like this in life, and oftentimes you're in their company for longer than you want to be. But there is a hilarious section in this book where they're at the funeral afterwards, and Renton is trying to lighten the mood, and he reminds Begbie of a time that they were down at Aintree, and they actually bumped into none other than Keith Chegwin, who was doing interviews for the day. And Matty himself was delighted to be interviewed for the telly by Keith Chegwin, but when Cheggers approached Begbie, he was promptly told to fuck off. Just like the way Begbie's remembering, aye, Cheggers, that's the cunt. I think, like Mike Baldwin, I kind of wish that Cheggers had made it into the movie version. Next, we have a small section called Straight Dilemmas, number one. This is obviously a clever little twist on the Junk Dilemmas. So this is Renton's new kind of reflections on life as a sober man, or at least a man off heroin. So it's a different perspective on the Junk Dilemma sections. You know, he's been offered drugs at a party that he's at, and the other people have no idea of, you know, how strong an affliction he's had with drugs in the past. You know, he says, I think I'll pass on your kind offer. Call me a wanker if you will, but I've always been a bit nervous around drugs, and I know a few people who've been into them and run into difficulties. The next one is Kelly's last chapter. It's entitled Eating Out. So Kelly is working as a waitress in an Edinburgh restaurant, and there's some pretty rude, chauvinistic male customers have come in, you know, typical kind of almost yuppie types, or who are, you know, at the table and making sexist remarks about her. And it's really the last straw for her in terms of male chauvinism. She does remark that she'd been living with Renton on and off for about 6 months, and, you know, that hasn't worked out either. But there's some disgusting, if not funny, descriptions here where she's behind the scenes in the kitchen area of the restaurant, and she lowers a bloody tampon from a very heavy period into the soup and squeezes it like a tea bag, squeezing out the manky black contents. She also mixes some of her, in her own words, cystitis-infused urine with their wine blends. And she also basically shites in a chocolate sauce for some profiteroles and ice cream. And she's also laced some ice cream with ground up traces of rat poison, which, you know, is going to cause problems for one of these rude gentlemen at the table when she serves it up to them. And it has a funny ending as well, where she mentions that she's writing a college essay. In my essay, I now think that I'd be forced to put that in certain circumstances, morality is relative. That's if I'm being honest with myself. But this is not Dr. Lamont's view, though, so I may have to stick with absolutes in order to curry favour and get high marks. I just love that kind of funny off-subject ending to the horrible goings-on in the kitchen area of that restaurant. Next is a small but very important chapter. It's called Trainspotting at Leith Central Station. It's narrated by Renton, and it's basically Renton returning to Leith for Christmas time. And he meets up with Begbie after a short meeting with a very drunk second prize down an alleyway. Second prize basically tried to assault him, but he's met up with Begbie, and they're making a way across the old section of a disused Leith Central Railway Station. And they see this, you know, what looks like a homeless man, or an old alcoholic anyway, who's approaches them and starts asking them, oh, what are you up to, lads? Train spotting, is it? And just starts laughing uncontrollably. And Begbie just answers him back, yeah, that's right. And then under his breath, you know, that he's a fucking old cunt. And the old man then, well, I'll leave you to it. Keep up the train spotting, mind. And he staggered off. And it was at this point that Renton realises that it's actually Begbie's father. And I suppose I've always found it a little bit strange that the title of the book centers around Begbie and not Renton himself, but it's a clever little way to bring it in. There's a couple of different reasons or speculation as to why the book is called Trainspotting, but that's possibly the main reason. The next small chapter is called A Leg Over Situation, and it's Renton going to visit Swanee, who at this point has had to have his leg amputated due to heroin use. And I suppose on the surface, Swanee is laughing it all off and seems full of hope. He keeps going on about, you know, making his way to Thailand and living the dream, but he still has a nasty streak in him. He mentions that Alison had visited him a few days before, and he, you know, strongly requested fellatio from her, but she certainly didn't like the look of his festering sores on his genitals, so she gave it a miss. But, you know, it just shows that he still has a kind of vicious streak in him, or a not so very nice character trait. But amazingly, Swanee is not HIV positive, which is remarkable, given the length of his habit. The next chapter is Winter in West Granton. And this is one of the more hard-hitting ones, I think, for me anyway. It's narrated by Renton, and it's him going to visit Tommy, who was now dying of AIDS. And Tommy actually looks already dead. You know, there's something missing in him. There is a mention of the abusive graffiti outside his council flat walls, where he's been recognised as someone who's HIV positive and basically being treated like a leper in his society. There's mention here by Irvine Welsh, his friends will decline in numbers as his needs increase. The inverse or perverse mathematics of life. And Tommy does get angry with Renton, who is still HIV free. Despite sharing with everyone, but Renton insists that he never did share, and that's never clarified for sure. But there's another good line here. It says, kicking and using again is like going to prison. Every time you go to jail, the possibility of you ever becoming free from that kind of life decreases. Possibly my favourite piece of writing in the whole book is in this chapter, but I will leave that for the next section of the book that I'm going to read. The next chapter is called A Scottish Soldier, and it's a third person narration, but it centres around Swanee, who's gotten out of hospital now and is begging on the streets, and he's posing as a soldier who had served his time in the Falklands, which is where he lost his leg. So it's interesting that Swanee gets this penultimate chapter, which is what it is, and I kind of thought that his hospital chapter was a suitable ending for him. But I suppose this does highlight the aspect of homelessness, albeit a devious one, through his conning of people. And that brings us to the last section, which is Exit, and the last chapter, which is entitled Station to Station. It's a long one, but it's a very good one. It's basically revolves around Renton, Sick Boy, Begbie, Spud and Second Prize going to London to engage in a low-key heroin deal. They've gotten their hands on some heroin, and they're heading down to meet up with a contact of Sick Boys to, you know, sell this heroin and make a sizable profit for themselves. There's a brilliant and hilarious section, you know, on the bus where Begbie's just completely on edge with this bag of money. And there's a good description here. He looks around, staring at the other passengers, feeling a desperate need for one, just one, to make eye contact, to give him a target to unleash the fury within him, which threatens to overwhelm him and fuck the consequences. No, he had to stay in control. There was too much at stake. There was everything at stake. There is nobody looking at Begbie, though. Those who were not oblivious to him could feel the vibes he was giving out. They employ that special talent people have, pretending nutters are invisible. Even his companions won't meet his gaze. So there's some good stuff here. Spud is actually wearing a Republic of Ireland jersey. I do have to wonder why Second Prize is even part of this, why they've included him in this deal. Because, you know, talk about a liability. He's pretty much drunk the whole time and contributes nothing. Sick Boy does mention that Rab's destiny was to be a drunk. He had actually had a promising football career, which was cut short, which really just proved to be a temporary distraction for what Sick Boy sees to be his real calling in life, which is to be an alcoholic. I like the way Sick Boy keeps his distance and is out of sight right until the last minute when the bus is leaving, just in case they were going to get nabbed by police. And he's actually accompanied by one of his girls. As I say, at this point, he is a pimp, and he's just in full-scale sleazy scumbag mode at this time. You know, he's waving and kissing her goodbye, but he's totally, you know, uncomplimentary to her behind her back. And he is worried about Begbie's temper or Spud's bad luck, which could result in them all going to prison. The drugs, this uncut Colombian brown that they've gotten their hands on, they've apparently bought this off Seeker, which is obviously different to the movie. But Renton himself, actually, he's not forced into testing it like in the movie, but he just can't resist it. It's the real thing, he's argued, a once-in-a-life chance for a hit for an Edinburgh junkie who's used to cheap Pakistani heroin. And as Spud has always gone along for the ride, so they both have taken this heroin before the bus ride. But Begbie is definitely wound up by Sick Boy's lateness and for being with this young prostitute. You know, the sick boy tries to curry favor with him by trying to turn Begbie's attention to Renton and Spud being in, you know, on after face on heroin, but Begbie's still agitated by sick boy instead. Renton does sneak in one last hit in the toilet on the bus without Spud. He's actually pretending to have a shite, so he has to come out and pretend he's not as, you know, under the influence of heroin as he actually is. As the bus ride goes on, he actually, this is where there's mention to Sick Boy having a ponytail, because Renton actually tries to burn it, and Sick Boy moves away from his, you know, childish friends at this point and moves up the bus and befriends an attractive American tourist. But Begbie actually warns him off her. He said, you know, he says to make sure she doesn't get ripped off, which would obviously draw attention to them. Sick Boy does get his hotel details off her, though, and he's quite disappointed to learn that it's not a more upmarket hotel in London. But he still might plan to pay her a visit. Once they get to London, they tell the taxi man that they're actually down for a Pogues gig in Finsbury Park, which is interesting. I thought that might help me put a date on when this is meant to be taking place, but not really, because the Pogues actually played a concert in Finsbury Park around Paddy's Day every year from 1990 to 1993. So it's still up in the air as to what year or date this is actually taking place. But as I say, the drugs are from Seeker, and the deal has been set up by Sick Boy with a guy called Andreas in London, who's a Greek who inherited a hotel. And he's pretty much turned that into a brothel. And they've gotten to know each other through going out with the same woman, who was apparently mesmerized by the both of them. But they hit it off instantly and started working on scams down in London, you know, mainly petty insurance fiddles and bank card frauds. But since taking over the hotel, Andreas has started to try and distance himself from Sick Boy, you know, deciding that he's now in a bigger league. But he has set him up with this drug dealer to take the money off them. The drug dealer, who is not named in the film and, you know, is played by Keith Allen, but in the book he is named as Pete Gilbert. And he does clock the Scottish guys for what they are, small-time wasters who've stumbled onto a big deal. But he is impressed by the quality of the deal, and he offers them 15 grand, but is prepared to go as high as 17 secretly. They want 20 grand, but they're prepared to go as low as 18. But apparently the deal is clinched at 16 grand. So Gilbert will apparently make about 60 grand minimum once this gear has been cut and distributed. And he does find it tiresome negotiating with this kind of bunch of fucked up losers from the wrong side of the border. You know, he'd rather be dealing with the person who actually sold them the drugs in Scotland. But he will keep Sick Boy and company sweet, because whoever was stupid enough to sell them the first lot of gear will possibly be stupid enough to do it again. So once the deal is done, the group split up. Spud and Rab go sightseeing, because it's apparently their first time in London. And Begbie and Sick Boy go off to play pool. Renton at this point is pretending to be sick, and it is at this point that he decides to steal the money all for himself and just do a runner once and for all. So the tension is magnificent as he decides to steal the money. You know, the description here, gripping the head sports bag firmly, Renton turns and stealthily scutters out of the room, down the stairs and along the hallway. He looks back briefly before striding out the door. If he bumped into Begbie now, he was finished. As soon as he lets that thought form consciously in his head, he almost collapses with fear. Whenever he sees a black leather jacket similar to Begbie's, his blood turns to ice. So he gets himself a return ticket to Amsterdam, obviously never intending to return. A few years ago, as mentioned, and it's more in Skag Boys, he had worked on a ferry as a steward, and he certainly hopes that nobody recognises him from those days. And, you know, he then starts to think about the friends that he's just ripped off. So, you know, as regards Sick Boy, he just speculates that he won't have any trouble recouping the cash, you know, because he's a born exploiter. It probably would hurt Sick Boy, the betrayal, but really and truly, the kind of mutual antagonism that had become a joke for the performance of others had really become a reality between the two. And, you know, in a way, Sick Boy would understand and even have a grudging admiration for his actions. It didn't take him long to realise that he'd probably done Second Prize a favour. You know, Second Prize was actually so busy destroying himself that he'd probably scarcely noticed that somebody was giving him a hand. His real guilt was centered around Spud. You know, He loved Spud. Spud had never hurt anyone. And if there was one person that he tried to compensate, it would be Spud. And that, of course, left Begbie, who he had no sympathy for whatsoever. You know, he goes into detail once again that this is a man who used to sharpen knitting needles so that when he went to sort somebody out, there was less chance of it hitting the rib cage like a knife and going straight through to vital organs. You know, he remembers a time when Begbie glassed a chap called Roy Schnedden in Devine Pub for absolutely nothing. You know, nothing other than the fact that the guy has an irritating voice and Begbie had a hangover. And Renton is ashamed of the fact that, you know, in the aftermath of that attack, they'd all backed Begbie up, you know, and agreed with his false accusations against this guy and had gone along with it to further massage Begbie's ego and make up for this horrible thing that he'd done. So Renton really comes to the realization that Begbie is the key here. You know, by doing this to him, he's ensured that he can never return to Leith or really Scotland in general. And the book ends with him remarking that now free from them all for good, he could be whatever he wanted to be. He could stand or fall alone. This thought both terrified and excited him as he contemplated life in Amsterdam. So that's the book, and I'd like to move on to my next section, which is speaking about my favourite bits, some my favourite sections of writing. And the first section is from the chapter Bad Blood, and it's when Alan Venters made no reaction to Davy Mitchell's false revelation that he'd knowingly contracted someone with HIV. I just like the writing here. He says, "His selfishness and lack of morality sickened me. I wanted to take him apart with my bare hands there and then. I fought to control my senses, savouring the richness of my plan to destroy him. The disease could have his body. That was its victory. Whatever malignant force it was, mine would be a greater one, a more crushing one. I wanted his spirit. I planned to carve mortal wounds into his supposedly everlasting soul. Amen." And then, as he realised that he'd convinced Venters that he'd found a kindred spirit, Irvine Welsh writes, "Then it happened. That cunt Venters rolled his eyes and smiled at me. That did it. That was the moment. The anger was still there, but it was now fused with a great calmness, a powerful clarity. I smiled back at him, feeling like a semi-submerged crocodile eyeing a soft, furry animal drinking at the river's edge." I just like that, the description of how Davy Mitchell was feeling at the time with this, you know, revenge just totally consuming him. The next bit of writing that I really loved is in the chapter There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. And it's just this brilliant description of the kind of street leading into the pub where they enter. The group enters, you know, after an all-night bender. And I just like the writing here. It's, "They emerge from the stairwell into the darkness of the deserted street. Some of them move in a jerky, manic way, exuberant and noisy. Others cruise along silently like ghosts, hurting inside, yet fearful of the imminence of even greater pain and discomfort. It's 5:06 a.m. and the hostelry's yellow lights are on, a haven in the dark, wet and lifeless streets. It had been, Spud reflects, a few days since he had last seen the light. They were like vampires, living a largely nocturnal existence, completely out of synchronization with most of the other people who inhabited the tenements and lived by a rota of sleep and work. It was good to be different." The group entered the pub, are also driven by need. The need for more alcohol to maintain the high or to regain it and fight off the onset of grim, depressive hangovers. They're also drawn by a greater need, the need to belong to each other, to hold on to whatever force has fused them together during the last few days of partying. And the last section I just want to speak on is probably my favourite couple of passages in the book. It's in winter in West Granton, and it's when Renton is going to visit Tommy for what would prove to be the last time he ever seen his friend. So Tommy would not survive winter in West Granton. "I'm sorry, mate. I really am sorry. I just repeat. Got any gear?" he says, raising his head and looking straight at me. "I'm clean now, Tommy." When I tell him, he doesn't even sneer. "So was then, mate. I'm expecting a rent check." I dig into my pockets and produce 2 crumpled fivers. I'm thinking about Matty's funeral. It's odds on that Tommy's next, and there's fuck all anybody can do about it, especially me. He takes the money. Our eyes meet and something flashes between us. It's something I can't define. It can't define, but it's something really good. It's just there for a second and then it's gone. And this is not really a gripe or a fault with the book in any way, but the only thing that stood out for me for mention is that the major suffering of the women in the book, i.e. the domestic violence by Begbie or the death of Leslie's baby, or even the public display of violence witnessed by Tommy, they're almost portrayed quite subtly in a weird way. And by that I mean that they're not written from the woman's point of view that's suffering very often. And none of the horror that these women go through is written in a first-person narrative, you know, except for Kelly and Gina, who do speak firsthand on the harassment that they've been subjected to. And I think that's an important inclusion by Irvin Welsh. But this is a debut book by a male writer, and he is very considerate, as I've said, towards females in it. But I just found possibly the choice of female characters selected for having their own chapters was possibly a little strange. And we're into my last section, which is the overall thoughts. So yeah, Irvin Welsh has this ability to write about, you know, both the good and the bad in people. Like their funny or redeeming qualities, as well as their horrible or downright terrifying aspects. And, you know, he's an everyman himself. And so he writes a lot of characters from a normal everyman perspective. But he then adds the kind of over the top rotten parts of a person's psyche that usually remains hidden to the outside world. And these are the things that can make a person interesting and make a story compelling. And he does that so well here in Trainspotting. Now, this is a book that's just a brilliantly put together snapshot of working class life in Scotland. And we can pretty much relate to it here in Ireland and many places around the world. You know, I'm very lucky to have not been involved or affected directly by heroin use. But, you know, I have lived in or close to areas that are affected by drugs or crime. So I can certainly relate to certain aspects of the book and other aspects as well, such as the Catholic upbringing or even just the drink and drug culture in general. The book itself actually reminds me a lot of Last Exit to Brooklyn by Hubert Selby Jr. I think it has a similar layout and it gives you kind of an inside view of the harsh realities of life in a specific area through different characters. But I think that the driving force of the book is the stories of friendship, whether they're forced or otherwise, and betrayal and revenge. I think that he paints an amazing picture which speaks on the sins of society and the pain suffered by individuals. The writing is just so hilarious in parts and hopelessly melancholic in others. Like the stories of Matty and Tommy's downward spiral are just so depressing, as are parts of Renton's narrative. But I think the complexity of Renton is just remarkable. You know, you see his disgusting warts and all traits that, you know, every person has, but you never actually get to see usually, coupled with his strengths, which are that he's, you know, basically has a head on his shoulders and is essentially a good human being to humans anyway. But all of these aspects about him just make for such interesting reading. I think the book is downright frightening in parts with the domestic violence acts by Begbie. But yet he is also somehow written as this, you know, comic character in other sections, which I think is just testament to Welsh's ability as a writer and a storyteller. I think there's a lot of hard subjects that are actually referenced quite subtly in the book, such as alcoholism or poverty or even indeed mental illness. None of these subjects are particularly spelled out, more strongly hinted at, but I think overall, you know, Irvin Welsh really shines a light well on all these subjects. He just shines a light on some for longer than others. But overall, this is one of my favourite books ever, and I think it's the best debut ever, in my view. You know, Catch 22, Fight Club, The Catcher in the Rye, The Wasp Factory, Carrie. These are all brilliant, amazing novels, but I don't think any of them are quite as good as this. So I'm definitely giving Trainspotting 5 out of 5. I just want to mention briefly the other adaptations of the book. The first being that, you know, the stage production of it, pretty immediately after the book was published in the 90s. I think Ewan Bremner played Renton in this version. I never had the pleasure of seeing this version, but I can totally see him playing a version of Renton that's more loyal to the book, that possibly has more layers to him, including his vulnerability or low self-esteem at times, which is mentioned in the book. I think all round he's, you know, rougher around the edges than Ewan McGregor is or did bring to the screen. So I'm sure that was amazing. I did have the pleasure of seeing a wonderful production of Trainspotting live by In Your Face Theatre when it came to Belfast a few years ago. You know, it's a just a loud, fast-paced, funny and hard-hitting production of the book. You know, just glow sticks, bare boobs, bare arses, and even the worst toilet in Scotland. It's just great performances by all the cast. It was so much fun to see, and I highly recommend it if it, you know, or when it gets back on the road. Hopefully it will include a trip to Dublin this time. And there is, of course, another adaptation, which brings me to my last segment, which is what's on the next episode. And it will be Danny Boyle's amazing 1996 masterpiece, Trainspotting. I don't want to say too much about it. I'll keep it for the next episode, but this is in my top three favorite movies of all time, and I like a lot of movies. So that is it. Keep an eye on the social media accounts, as I say, and until next time, thanks for listening.